Greetings, this is Jeff with Down Earth on Making Waves, sitting here with Peter Ijak, about to have a discussion about some of the projects that Peter's been working on related to solar power and alternative energy and a whole host of other things that I think folks will find really interesting.
I recently came up here about 5 years ago. Used to work for the Space Center for NASA. I worked there for 10 years, launching rockets for a living, and all the high-tech stuff that people dream about. I put myself through school. I got two master's degrees, and I'm a licensed pilot and aircraft mechanic. And I learned a lot through the ages, kind of learning all about different types of electrical systems. And I found that solar energy was very popular down in Florida. And when I lived in Florida, I had my own solar hot water heater on top of my roof, and that saved me a tremendous amount of you know, electricity for heating up a regular house, a hot water system. And I was very interested in the photovoltaic cells. And my home is right near, in Cocoa, is right near a renewable energy center. It's the only one pretty much in the whole southeast. And I went over there quite a bit and just learned a lot about stuff about solar energy power, hydroelectric, and any kind of renewable energy. So I lived there for 10 years and I moved up here about 5 years ago. I've always been interested in it. I recently bought some land. I'm looking to set up some new projects, doing an underground house, and I'm looking to maybe build a geostructured dome powered by solar energy. So I'm just doing a lot of different types of alternative energy. I just recently bought this electric car, at which point I'm trying to start up a renewable energy club just to educate and let, you know, spread the word about renewable energy and how it affects people's lives and how we can better benefit from it. So there's all kinds of ways that you can save energy, save the environment, and in fact, you're going to be saving our world. We can you know, reduce the pollution that cars put out.
Not to mention the noise level.
The noise level, exactly.
As you can all hear in the background.
Right, and I'm just doing my small part, getting an electric car and then driving around town. 90% of my commute time is within the city of Rochester. Everything's posted 30 miles or less. And I really don't need a car because most of the time I'm sitting in traffic or waiting for a stoplight and just burning gasoline, burning, you know, fuel. And I just, you know, I would like to save the earth a little bit and not pollute. I have this 100% electric car. It gets, I think it gets about 25 miles to the charge. It takes about 8 hours to charge up. And it costs me roughly about a penny per mile. I bought it for $3,700, pretty cheap. And it's been running really well. And I get a lot of different looks at it.
But we're sitting here outside and looking at the car right now, and if you could just tell the listeners what the car looks like and maybe...
The car is essentially a two-seater with a long 5-foot bed on the back, but like a, kind of a pickup truck. It all has ABC plastic all around it. It's got essentially a roll bar in the center part of it. You have a big thermal window up front, wind wipers, got the horn, turn signals, everything is like a regular car. You also have to get inspected and get it registered like a regular vehicle.
So it's all perfectly road.
Right, all, yep. And you can't really go faster than 30 miles in a posted speed limit, but everything pretty much downtown is 30 or less. I just, you know, at night I just plug it into a regular 110 outlet and charge it up. It takes about 8 hours to get a good full charge. And driving around town, it's a lot of fun. When you hit a bump, you feel it. It's not, it doesn't have all the features like a regular car. But it's convenient, it's very quick. And when I first started it up, I was expecting to hear an engine turning over, but I just heard a little click, and that was all. And it was very quiet, and it doesn't pollute, and that's one thing I like about it. It doesn't pollute. And I'm just doing a small part in just saving the environment, and I'm hoping to convert other people to try, you know, alternative forms of energy, like what I'm doing now, and in hopes that maybe somebody else is going to, you know, kind of a roll effect. Everybody's going to try one, you try another one. I definitely enjoy it, but, you know, I recommend this to anybody.
And I find it interesting how you were down in Florida literally doing rocket science, and how did you end up in Rochester, New Hampshire, interested in solar? You know, you have an ice cream place and a bakery here, and I'm just, it's a real transition. I think it's great. Could you just talk about that?
Sure, sure. Actually, when I was living in Florida, I had two electric cars here myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was living there for 10 years. It was fun. I wanted to be on my own, kind of have my own business. and I was getting tired of working for the government. It was just so much waste down there. It was just incredible. I moved up to New Hampshire mainly because I wanted to be my own boss. My family's from this area. My family runs the governor's inn in Rochester here. And I've been for the last year and a half, I've on the conservation committee here with the city of Rochester. Mm-hmm. And living in Florida, there's a lot of solar energy down there, a lot of great weather. But I just wanted to move back up to where I'm kind of born up in this area. And I think the people are really nice up here, more so down in Florida. You kind of work for somebody for 10 years and you want to just try to be on your own and just get out and try something different. Mm-hmm. And then I bought this old building. The city was actually going to condemn it. I said, perfect, it's a project, okay? And I kind of rebuilt the whole thing, put all new windows in, new sidings, new insulation. I put a whole new heating system in, and I put a tankless water heater. And a tankless water heater runs off kerosene, which has one of the highest BTUs, more so than natural gas or propane. And that could save you a considerable amount of money. And then I put all new energy systems in. I put all T12 light bulbs and light fixtures in. I approached the state, and they came out and they gave me like an energy audit. And they said, well, whatever light fixtures you put in, we'll give you $20 per fixture. And I installed them myself. When you change out a light fixture from a T12 to a T8, then you save about 40% on your electricity bill. So it was worth it definitely in the long run to do that. Any type of air conditioning system you put in or heating systems, you can check with the state because they have a lot of renewable energy incentives trying to help the people save energy. And just check with the PSNA. They have a good website on that.
Could you talk a little bit about the broader picture and how what you've done connects to kind of the national or even the global environmental condition? How do you see what you're doing as connected to that, and what do you see as some of the things that we're going to need to deal with?
Well, I feel that eventually the oil is going to run out. China is sucking up a lot of fuel. America consumes 25% of all the world's supply of oil. Eventually, this oil is going to run out. There's going to be so much more demand than supply, and the price is going to start skyrocket up. Our whole society, as we know it right now, depends on oil for transportation. People don't realize that you go to a store and you buy food. Well, some truck had to deliver that stuff over there, and it's going to affect the world over. Once the energy supply is limited, people are going to say, "Well, I need to find another way to live." If we start working on it now and trying to kind of having a future. Taking a look at the future, what's going to happen in 20 years.
Being proactive as opposed to reactive.
Yeah, instead of going out there and saying, well, this is going to happen and I can't change it, then I don't have to worry about it. Mm-hmm. But if you take right now and take steps to make a change, then you'll be better off in the future. I like to build an underground house. The purpose of an underground house is that when you go about 2 feet underneath the ground, the temperature of the ground is about a constant 50 degrees. Mm-hmm. So if you're in the wintertime, you're about 50 degrees, then you have to bring up the heat. It's called a delta heat, and you have to bring it from 50 to 70, and it's a lot less energy than you have to bring it from, say, 0 to 70 degrees. And so you actually spend out a lot more energy trying to do that. And in the summertime, it's a constant 50 degrees, nice and cool. So a lot of the animals actually burrow into the ground to hibernate. So
you're kind of mimicking nature, basically.
Yeah.
Biomimicry is a full field of science now. It's being.
And you don't have to worry about painting your house or having a roof on it. You can have a nice grass roof on it if you wanted to.
What about light though? What about sunlight?
You can always have solar light coming in. You can make these little solar domes or whatever to allow the sun to come in. People always worry about how much moisture or is going to be fungus on the walls. It all depends on how good waterproofing you actually make the walls. You probably build the walls out of cement. Mm-hmm. And just do some really good drainage as well as waterproofing the walls. You have to have a good exchange of air into the basement or in the room to exchange all the air out. You can power the whole place up with solar panels or some kind of a wind generator. If you're lucky enough to live near a small stream, you can have a hydroelectric generator to generate your own electricity. And you'd be surprised how much right now the state, as a matter of fact, they actually allowed what's called net metering. And net metering is that any kind of energy you make, they automatically have to buy it from you. And then they sell it back to you at their regular rates.
We had that out in Oregon. I had a friend whose house was actually, in the summertime, the meter would turn backwards.
Yeah.
And he'd actually sell power back to the state.
So, yeah, so it's something to consider. So eventually I want to power this whole building with solar.
This place right here?
This place here. I have a huge roof on top of this place right here.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to just power the whole thing up with solar panels. So I'm not sure if it'll work too well, but I'm going to go out and try it. I'm also possibly going to be contacting a contractor to see if I can maybe do a geothermal system on this house here. But
on this place? Right?
This place, yeah. The geothermal, instead of having, you can have these loops running, or you can do the horizontal, or you can do, you know, dig these long tunnels into the earth and power the heating system that way. But possibly by that time, you'll be seeing fuel cells out there. And the fuel cells, you can essentially just power it up by water or whatever. But that's just on the
thing. What do you think the timetable on that?
On the fuel cells?
You'll
probably see it within the next 20 years. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of vehicles are probably going with the fuel cells. They might be going with hydrogen. Although hydrogen is not as effective as just pure electrical cells. So. And then, so there's all kinds of ways to power your house. You know, power your cars. I think that, you know, right now the current political scene with all the oil, we're depending so much oil from the Mideast.
Yeah.
And we're spending, you know, boohoo amounts of money to send our boys over there to protect our interests over there, which is strictly the oil. And, you know, we went to the a war with Iraq, okay, and just, you know, we're trying to protect our oil interests over there. If we could, you know, have a little more self-reliance on our own system, or find it within our own, you know, in the Pacific area or the over in Alaska, I don't feel that we should be going out there and destroying all these, you know, natural wildlife areas for looking for oil. But we could save so much oil by reducing our cars instead of having all these SUVs on the road. Build cars lighter, smaller. Look over in Europe, okay, Europe has got so many small cars there. They don't have these big monsters that we have over here. Which, you know, they got the Humvee and all these expensive 15, 20 miles to the gallon tank. Europe, the gas prices are about between $5 and $6, and they drive small, efficient vehicles.
From what I understand, the price, they actually, some of that money goes to the true cost of the oil, which we don't factor in to the cost. Everything is artificially cheap here, whether it's wood products or oil or water, and we don't factor in the cleanup costs and the pollution and health costs of that.
I don't know if you saw that show called Oil Storm.
I didn't, actually.
No, it was a really good show about what would happen if a major hurricane took out a big oil refinery down in the near Louisiana.
Uh-huh.
And they actually produce like 20% of all the oil in the United States here.
Louisiana does?
Yeah, in Louisiana. They refine it. They take it out of the Gulf, okay, out of these oil rigs, and they bring it there and they refine it. That's 20% of all the oil that's supplied to the United States that way.
Mm-hmm.
And we depend on so much on other forms of oil, but mainly from, you know, Saudi Arabia. So if any kind of a terrorist attack saying, okay, we don't want to provide the United States with oil anymore, there would be major upheavals, you know, everything would be in chaos. If you happen to saw that movie, it was a really startling, eye-opening experience. Put on by about 2 weeks ago, about showing the realities of what would happen if the oil, you know, due to a major hurricane, completely flattened a refinery, and that the oil supply was depleted, and then they saw like the price of gasoline was like $8 a gallon, and nobody could afford that, and then everybody says, well, I'm not paying for that. And people were freezing up in the Northeast because they couldn't afford the fuel oil. It just shows what could happen to the whole world we live in right now. We take everything for granted. But if something like this were to happen, that we had a depletion in the oil supply, your whole life, would stop.
Mm-hmm.
We depend on oil for heating our homes, the gas bills, for the car we drive, to the food we get in the stores, to all the different types of products that are made by oil.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of things that we don't, you know, we take for granted now. But going back to the political scene, I think that Bush has got a lot of you know, political interest and a lot of monetary interest in the big refineries, the big, you know, gas companies.
Mm-hmm. So there was just a guy that quit. I can't remember his name. I heard this on NPR. He quit, and about a week ago, it was reported that he he was the editor of these reports on greenhouse gases, and he went and edited all that information out. He used to work as an oil company lobbyist. He just got a job with ExxonMobil.
Really?
And they're saying there's no connection. Scott McClellan,
the press secretary, or whatever.
So it's so blatant. It's really.
I mean, I've heard reports that Bush has got all these tie-ins with over in Saudi Arabia, and Bush is from Texas, and he's kind of very influential with all the oil companies. So I think there's a big scam going on in the state. All these big oil companies, they don't want to, push for all these, energy-saving things. I went to, about 10 years ago, I was over at Walt Disney World, the Epcot Center, and I saw a car there that got 200 miles to the gallon. And this is produced by GM, and I've never seen it on the roads at all, because they don't want to push for these things, that they want to, they want everybody to spend a lot of money for gas. So it feeds their pocketbook. So I think it's just a big racket going on. I think they could really build really efficient cars, but they don't want to do that because then they're going to be, getting a pinch on their pockets.
Right. We kind of need what we had after World War II, Marshall Plan, or even the response to 9/11, just this overwhelming response to deal with the problem. I remember, the space shuttle was before my time, but when the Russians were beating us, what did they do? They put all the resources and decided we were going to go into space, we were going to get to the moon, and sure enough, they did it. So I agree. I think if we really wanted to, if the priorities weren't so messed up in this country, we would be there.
We could do it, but there has to be a good, kind of a spike thing. Well, we got to do this, and so it's, I don't know, I mean, if we had another president in there, who knows, that could have been a lot more envy, systems out there.
It's true. This week, they're actually debating the energy bills. Been going on for a while. They've obviously authorized drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which, according to all experts, is just a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, the only company that's really that interested in drilling there is ExxonMobil. The rest of them are kind of like, well, it's not really worth it.
Right.
It kind of makes you wonder if they're just doing it because they figure if they can drill there, then they can drill anywhere.
Right. And they're eventually going to want to do that.
Yeah. So national parks.
I think we just got to stay away from, if we can actually consume less, we'll be actually saving more and not having to rely on so many outside sources for our oil supply.
Right.
But if we even cut down our speed from everybody drives now 65, 70 miles an hour, we brought that down to 50 miles an hour, on the road, you'd be surprised how much fuel you'll save on that, Because the faster you go with the car, the less efficient it gets.
Yeah. What is the optimal speed in a car?
50.
You would get 50.
Yep, they say 50
because
you have a higher wind drag ratio, and so the faster you go, the more drag is actually introduced, and the further the engine has to run to bring the car to speed. But I mean, there's so many ways to save money, save energy, save the world, or save the environment that people are not even aware of it. Maybe they don't even care. I don't know.
Well, and it's, I'm sitting here looking at your vehicle, you have an ice cream place. Seems like you're having a lot of fun doing it, too.
I do. I'm enjoying this.
Really enjoy it. And obviously, you're starting an alternative energy or renewable energy club.
Renewable energy club, just to get people out. I know a bunch of people over at UNH who would like to come out and talk to us. There's other people who are very concerned about the environment, and they want to let people know about it. And so I'm just trying to bring people together, get the word out.
Provide a forum.
Maybe get some speakers in. I'd like to go up. There's a wind farm up here in Rochester. A gentleman's got his whole house powered by the wind.
Rochester.
And I've been out to his place already. I've seen it and talked to him. He's got all these big battery banks. And he powers up his whole house with a big wind generator. And then sells the rest of it back to the utility company. And I thought that was really neat. And so there's other people out there that, they're trying to do this. They're trying to make an impact, a change. I'm just one person trying to make a change. And if other people can do it, but instead of taking a regular bulb and putting a fluorescent bulb in, you're saving money. You're saving saving energy.
I know in my house I'm letting all the bulbs burn out until they're all dark. Like the ones outside, I now have no lights on outside. The ones in my barn, the 6 bulbs, and I'm going to buy all energy efficient bulbs. Granted, I probably should not wait to buy them until they're all burnt up, but
change them out now, But eventually, lights are going to be going on with the LEDs, Okay. Mm-hmm. I just recently put a new sign up 2 days ago. There's a big sign up top of the building. That's all LEDs, rather than going with a regular lighted sign with a fluorescent bulb.
Right.
LEDs consume like 1/10 of the power of a fluorescent bulb, and they say you can still last for like 100 to 200 years without just being changed out. So that you'll
100 to 200 years.
Right. You'll see that technology advancing from fluorescence to LEDs,
mm-hmm.
and practically all the city lights right now, the traffic signals are going with all LEDs.
Mm-hmm.
So they consume with so little power, and they don't put any. Most of the for a regular light output, produce a lot of heat. Okay.
Yes.
Fluorescents
yeah.
don't put that much heat out,
yeah.
and now LEDs probably don't put any heat out. So it's a lot more energy efficient, and eventually you'll see houses with all LED lights in there. I had contact once over at PSNH, and they came out and did a static test on my house. They sort of like a little vacuum, and they tested to see how much of a leakage I have in. And then they mm-hmm. give you incentives to try to fix those little problems.
Mean energy leaks from the winter.
Energy leaks in the winter.
Yeah.
Maybe upgrading your windows from a single pane to a double pane or a triple pane. Putting more insulation into your attic. These are all ways to save money and save energy.
Right.
And you're also saving the environment and not relying so much on foreign oil. And if we don't have to rely on foreign oil so much, then we don't have to have go out there and try to take over a country to see if we can get their oil interest. And that way we don't have to risk American lives overseas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much money that the government's pouring in to do all this military strategies over in Iraq. And
yeah, I'm thinking like they spent that $300 million
right.
on an energy policy in this country that made sense and that wasn't suicide, which in my opinion is what we're at right now.
Right. I mean, we're eventually going down the tubes, and if we don't do something soon to change it, we're all going to be important.
You'll have your ice cream stand here, and you'll be on solar, and everybody else will be,
yeah.
it'll all be out of energy, but you'll have, it'll be funny to see if
you
come and get an ice cream during some kind of a crisis.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do eventually, convert this whole building over.
Yeah.
But eventually I want to, kind of move up to my farm, and I just have a large farm there. Everything's powered by solar or geothermal or wind energy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's eventually where I want to progress to.
Yeah. Well, thank you. And I really want to, you've inspired me quite a bit off on these topics.
Good.
The nuts and bolts get left out, and we just talk gloom and doom and how bad everything is. And we got to do something, and it's great to hear somebody actually doing it and just totally going for it. I can't tell you how excited when I saw this article, I was just like, exactly what I'm looking for, because I wanted to connect with people who are interested in this, because quite frankly I don't know all the nuts and bolts.
Right,
I just
right.
have the big picture, and I don't like what I see, so I want to do mm-hmm. something about it.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in this either. I just have a fascination on it. I read Home Power magazines, okay, and I read the Mother Earth news, and I'm always seeing these articles about save this and save the world, and kind of the types of energy products that will be more environmental safe and for nature. And I think this is great. I'd like to take my part of this and just, I kind of read up anything that will save the environment and make things that don't have any pollution on it.
Can you tell us or tell the listeners how they might contact you or get involved in the Renewable Energy Club?
You can contact me at 603-332-5278, or you can contact me through the email, which is strictly just bluemonkeynh@yahoo.com. And you can contact me through that. And I believe we have meetings on the second Wednesday of the month.
What is the Blue Monkey, for people who don't know?
Oh, the Blue Monkey is an ice cream and bakery shop.
Because people might want to come and check that out as
well. Sure. It's I named it because of the first astronauts in space were monkeys, and they're all wearing blue flight uniforms.
Ah, okay.
So, and then the kids like the name, so something fun. It's kind of a catchy name also. So
great. And the meetings, again, are the first meeting on Wednesday, June 22nd at 7 p.m.?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. And then from there on, after that, they're going to be, that would be the third Wednesday.
Third Wednesday, I'm sorry.
Third Wednesday of every month.
Wednesday of every month.
At 7.
Yeah. And, so come on out, and if you like to learn more about it, or if anybody is interested in talking about it, or... I mean, I'm still a beginner at this, and I want to learn as much as I can. So if anybody knows more than I do, I'll be more than happy to listen to it. And if we can put some of these things into practice, that'd be great. You know, I have a lot of land up there. I'd like to do some experimenting, maybe build a straw bill house or...
Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I'm interested in.
Or something like that. There's all kinds of... You can build some, you know, any kind of adobe houses out of mud if you wanted to. I'd like to learn more about, you know, hydroelectric. Eventually, I want to go with a solar, a wind generator. So I'm learning all about that. I'm kind of a beginner in this field myself. So last year, I tried to talk to the city of Rochester to provide a kind of a clean energy bill here, or called a giving people who wanted to buy solar panels, wind energy, giving some kind of an energy tax credit or a tax rebate. So contemplating that, and they bring it up to some different workshops.
Right.
But, I actually published a little article in the paper regarding that. That's something I like to feel to happen in the local area. So. There's a lot of other towns in the state of New Hampshire that provide that as a tax exemption if you went with solar, hydro, or wind energy. So other than that, I'm just trying to encourage people to come out and sit down, meet other people, talk to each other, and I'll provide all the any kind of desserts and drinks. So.
All right, that alone is worth.
Yeah, come on out and enjoy then.
All right, great, thank you.
Was T-Bone Burnett with Humans from Earth. And now for Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bill Fletcher, president of Trans Africa Forum, who examines the agreement by the Group of Eight industrialized nations to cancel at least $40 billion of debt owed by 18 of the world's poorest countries. Anita Dunch, research director of the National Priorities Project, who discusses how cuts in military spending could enhance national security and restore some funding for critical domestic needs. And columnist and civil liberties advocate Nat Hentoff, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's push to make permanent controversial provisions of the USA Patriot Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Marking a new low point between the Republicans who run Congress and the United Nations, the International Relations Committee in the House of Representatives passed a bill authored by Committee Chairman Henry Hyde that could cut in half U.S. dues to the U.N. if certain reforms are not adopted. According to the Interpress Service, the proposed reforms include funding most U.N. programs voluntarily rather than through mandatory dues from the 191 member states. It also requires a new rule that prohibits alleged human rights abusers from sitting on the UN Human Rights Commission. The Hyde bill also calls for the U.S. to withhold funding for new or expanded peacekeeping operations until specific reforms are in place. The Hyde bill was strongly criticized by defenders of the UN, such as Don Kraus of Citizens for Global Solutions, who asserted the bill will only further exacerbate our isolation in the world community at a time when we need allies. For months, Republicans on Capitol Hill have expressed public outrage about the UN oil for food scandal and comments by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan that the U.S.-led war in Iraq violates the UN Charter. Senator Norm Coleman, a Minnesota Republican who heads a key Senate committee, has called for Annan to quit. George Galloway, a British member of Parliament accused of involvement in the oil for food scandal by Coleman, testified before a Senate committee and called the charge, which he denied, the mother of all smokescreens. Ignoring harsh criticism from human rights groups and the United Nations, longtime Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is pushing ahead on his massive slum clearance campaign that has left 200,000 people homeless. 22,000 people have been arrested, mostly small traders in Harare, the capital city, and other urban areas, who have opposed Mugabe's 20-year rule. Speaking to the new parliament on June 9th in a session which was boycotted by the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, Mugabe said it was necessary to go after black market traders in currency, drugs, and key commodities like sugar who work outside government regulation in crime-ridden areas. In Geneva, Miloun Kotari, a leading UN expert on the right to housing, blasted the crackdown as a violation of human rights. He said the sweep would make Harare a city of the rich, for the middle class, for the well-off, and the poor are pushed away. Kotari predicted that ultimately 2 or 3 million people could be displaced by the slum clearance operation in Zimbabwe. Since Mugabe's government started seizing white-owned farms 5 years ago, Zimbabwe's economy has shrunk by 50%, and many people have been forced to become street vendors in order to survive. With unemployment at nearly 80%, 70% of the people in the southern African nation are poor, and one-third are in need of food aid. For the first time, animal rights activists in the U.S. are on trial for using tactics branded as terrorism by the government. In federal court in Trenton, New Jersey, prosecutors have charged 6 members of the group Stop Huntingdom Animal Cruelty with violating the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which in 2002 was expanded to include the crime of animal enterprise terrorism. The 6 animal rights activists face a possible 3-year jail sentence and a $250,000 fine. In recent years, activists have waged an intense campaign against Huntingdon Life Sciences, a British-based company with operations in New Jersey that tests drugs and food additives on animals. The animal rights group has allegedly harassed Huntingdon employees, published their names and addresses on its campaign website, and threatened their family members. Andrew Erba, a defense attorney for the 6 activists, told Reuters, "This is a referendum on the rights of a political movement to talk about these things in the open." In recent testimony to a U.S. Senate committee, the FBI's counterterrorism chief, John Lewis, claimed that direct action animal rights groups were now more dangerous than the Ku Klux Klan, radical anti-abortion groups, and other right-wing extremist organizations. The FBI is investigating 1,200 incidents connected to animal rights groups over the last 15 years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
After years of petition drives, protests, and direct action by grassroots organizations across the globe, the Group of 8 industrialized nations agreed to cancel at least $40 billion of debt
owed to international lending agencies by 18 of the world's poorest countries. The nations affected, 14 of them in Africa, must adhere to neoliberal free market economic policy and anti-corruption measures. Money not going to debt service will be dedicated to funding health, education, and other anti-poverty programs. Non-governmental organizations from around the world that had long campaigned for debt relief greeted the G8 agreement with guarded optimism. Some pointed out that economic conditions attached to the debt relief program exacerbated poverty. Other organizations noted that 44 impoverished nations not covered in the G8 agreement will continue to be burdened by devastating debt. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, chair of the upcoming G8 summit in Scotland, had led the effort for debt relief and is still hoping to gain commitments to double current levels of international aid to poor African nations. But Blair's appeal for Washington to sign onto an expansion of Africa aid was rejected by President Bush. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Fletcher, president of Trans-Africa Forum, who examines the G8 debt agreement and the continuing struggle to combat poverty in Africa.
Well, my reaction is very mixed, I mean, just to be honest. On the one hand, any cancellation is a good thing, and it's moving things the way that they should go. But I think that it's important for your listeners to remember that the cancellations that were announced were the result of these countries accepting the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank's prescriptions for their economies. So in other words, it's like this. It would be as if I said to you, I will cancel your personal debt, but you have to divorce your wife, send your kids to the schools that I pick with the curriculum that I like, and start buying the food that I think you should have. So it's that sort of arrangement that these countries have found themselves in. It's very unsettling. I think the other part is that it's far from complete. There are obviously many more countries that are in a similar situation in terms of odious debt. And on top of that, there is a perception that I'm starting to see in the media that because the number $40 billion is thrown around, that there's an assumption that this is it. I mean, that no further assistance is needed, when that's exactly the opposite case, that great levels of assistance are going to be needed at this point.
Lay out for us, if you would, the economic policies, the privatization, the free trade policies that these poor countries must adopt in exchange for receiving this debt relief.
Well, you certainly hit two of them. In all fairness, there's anti-corruption policies that the countries must adopt. I mean, no one's in favor of corruption. But the privatization is very, very important. I mean, a number of these countries had nationalized broad public sectors, growing from their beliefs as to how their economy should be shaped. As a condition of getting assistance, they had to privatize. They had to give up the decisions that they themselves had made, you know, about what their economy should look like. And so there's been privatization of electricity, of water, telecommunications in various cases. So you have that. Then you have, as you mentioned, free trade agreements. You know, listening to President Bush talk about free trade agreements is really quite sickening when you realize that there is no such thing as free trade on this planet, that the bigger economies always figure out ways of protecting certain key sectors of their own economies, and that no country has ever developed on the basis of free trade from a state of underdevelopment. It's never happened. Yet what's being asked and not asked, demanded of Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, is that they follow a path that has never been proven to succeed. And then, of course, last week, Prime Minister Blair was here to try to convince his good buddy that the United States should increase their aid to Africa. I mean, I think it's humiliating from the standpoint of Britain. I mean, here it is that Blair put everything on the line to back an illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. And you would just simply assume that President Bush would do a little extra for his ally. No, nothing. He basically digs up this figure, $650 million of aid for the African continent that he's going to add. But it turns out that wasn't his number anyway, that Congress had already allocated that amount. So effectively, Blair went home empty-handed. the situation is cynical when one looks at what's actually going on.
Bill Fletcher, where do you see the struggle headed now in terms of fighting poverty in Africa and other impoverished nations across the world after this G8 initiative here?
I think the countries of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean really need our continued voice and support in demanding full debt cancellation and significant increase in assistance for economic development purposes. You know, Prime Minister Blair was saying that the assistance needs to be doubled. And I think that he's right. I mean, we need to be looking at the equivalent of the Marshall Plan that was used with Europe after World War II and the devastation to rebuild Europe. That sort of assistance is necessary. And the economies of North America, Europe, and Japan are more than capable of providing that assistance. And so I think that this is where the fight needs to be. And we need to make this fight integral to everything that we do. I mean, one of the problems in the United States is that when it comes to Africa, we've allowed the media to put us to sleep. You know, people think of Africa as a house of horrors, that nothing ever works there, that it's a basket case, or we know very little about what's going on. And those of us that are active, those of us that are conscious about this, that have any concern, need to become more vocal. And this can't be the activity only of organizations in Washington, D.C. It's got to be organizations at the local level.
That was Bill Fletcher, president of Trans Africa Forum. Call the group at area code 202-223-1960 or visit their website at www.transafricaforum.org. Under the proposed federal budget for 2006, military spending totals $450 billion, seven times as much as all other homeland security and preventive measures combined. And that doesn't even include the $70 to $100 billion a year the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are costing. That money, due to political, not budgetary considerations, is not included in the defense budget. Last week, the National Priorities Project released a study showing how $53 billion could be cut from the military budget and redirected to increased protections against terrorist attacks, while also allocating $13 billion more into domestic needs. Those dollars, for example, could provide health coverage for almost 3 million uninsured Americans or build more than 100,000 low-income housing units. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anita Dunch, research director of the National Priorities Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization. She discusses how national tax and spending policies impact the country across a broad range of issues and programs.
We could have better security for less money. This is based on a report written by a number of partner organizations. And what's been found is that we could conservatively cut military programs by about $53 billion. Then we could redirect some of that money, in fact, most of that money, into other types of programs that improve our security, such as preventive measures, which include diplomacy, working internationally, and securing nuclear materials abroad, or homeland security, such as improving the security at ports or nuclear facilities or chemical plants. What we find is that we still have money left over. So basically, if we have a much more comprehensive, better security policy, we could have it for fewer dollars. We have left about $13 billion, and those dollars could be put towards deficit reduction, or they could be put towards addressing domestic needs.
The federal budget surplus when Bill Clinton left office was projected to grow to $5.6 trillion over the next decade. And instead, the deficit for last year alone was $445 billion. That's an amazing turnaround.
In 2000, when the Bush administration took over, the federal budget was in surplus, meaning we were taking in more money than we were spending. But quickly, that evaporated to nothing. And there's two major reasons why we now have large deficits. One is because of all of the various tax break packages that were passed over the last few years. And the second reason is because there's been this enormous boost in military spending and Homeland Security spending. You know, there's a number of military programs that continue to be funded, even though they're really from the Cold War era. These programs are unnecessary or they're redundant, and basically they're cost ineffective. For example, the F-A-22 Raptor aircraft. This is something that in the budget there will be $4.3 billion spent on next year, even though we can use less costly aircrafts and do what this aircraft is meant to do. Other examples are the submarines, there's destroyers. These are costing billions of dollars to develop new technologies to advance destroyers or submarines, even though they're really developing technologies to address the Soviet threat. And again, the Soviet threat has ended. The type of threats we face today require different measures. So we can save money on these unnecessary redundant programs. We have existing weapons that can do the same thing, and we can save money. For a very small amount of money, for less than $1 billion, we could redirect that towards some acts that have been proposed in Congress, such as the Chemical Safety Act, which would require chemical plants to assess their vulnerability and undertake appropriate measures to ensure better security in our homeland.
The latest budget issue that's drawn a lot of attention is the House plan to cut the budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting almost in half. Of course, a lot of people think that it's a political move, but the Republicans are couching it as a necessary budgetary move.
Congress wants to cut that percentage-wise by a tremendous amount. But if we look at how much money it would be cutting, it would be less than $200 million. This is a trivial part of the budget. In fact, if we look at our tax dollar, it's 2/100ths of a cent of our tax dollar. This is a very, very small piece of the federal budget. And yet, the argument is to cut it because we need to reduce the deficit.
Anita Dunch, do you see any moves by Congress to try to address the military squeeze on domestic spending? I know that Representative Lynn Woolsey, a Democrat of California, has introduced some kind of resolution regarding this.
There was a congressional resolution out of Representative Woolsey's office to shift some of the unnecessary military spending into programs that would address security deficits and address domestic needs. It may be proposed to be more than a congressional resolution and to actually be an amendment to an appropriations bill for the Department of Defense. But again, this will only happen if people let their elected officials know how they feel about these issues.
That was Anita Dunch of the National Priorities Project. Contact the group at area code 413-584-9556 or visit their website at www.nationalpriorities.org. Provisions of the USA Patriot Act, passed by Congress just 6 weeks after the September 11th terrorist attacks, are set to expire at the end of 2005. The Bush administration is now campaigning hard to make permanent some of the more controversial portions of the act that are due to sunset in December. In a closed session on June 7th, the Senate Intelligence Committee voted to make permanent 8 of these provisions and went on to expand the powers of the FBI to subpoena an individual's business records, allow wiretaps and searches without presenting links to terrorism or obtaining a judge's approval. President Bush stated that the Patriot Act has given law enforcement officials the powers needed to make the nation safe from terrorism. Although the president recently claimed that the legislation has resulted in 400 arrests and helped convict 200 people on terrorism charges, the Washington Post found that only 39 had been convicted of crimes related to terrorism.
Congressional opponents of some key provisions of the Patriot Act have been stymied in their attempt to publicly challenge the administration's claims and expose abuse of the law. A June 10th House Judiciary Committee hearing was abruptly ended by Committee Chair Republican James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin after hearing the testimony of four witnesses who questioned the constitutionality of the Patriot Act. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Village Voice columnist and longtime civil liberties advocate Nat Hentoff, who takes a critical look at what's at stake as the Bush administration pushes to make permanent controversial provisions of the USA Patriot Act.
The Senate Intelligence Committee is chaired by Pat Roberts. The idea of what kind of person he is, he has steadfastly refused to allow the Democratic ranking member, Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia, to even put in an amendment to have an independent inquiry of how we treat prisoners that we call detainees. But now he's gone beyond that in terms of attacking the core of the Constitution, many people would say, and that is the Fourth Amendment. Through his insistence in a closed-door session, he had the committee, a large percentage of the committee, pass a proposed bill that would give the FBI extended powers in a section of the Patriot Act that is now expanded so that the FBI can now issue that by themselves. They write their own subpoenas. They do not have to go to a judge, and they can secure personal records in all kinds of places, medical offices, libraries, post offices, and the like. The only people who can challenge this are the institutions that get the subpoena, whether they're doctor's offices or libraries or educational institutions. They can challenge it, but very few of them are likely to because they have no incentive to. They don't care what happens to the individuals whose records have been seized, and they'd rather not go to the bother and expense of going to court. The only way to stop this will be if the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is headed by Arlen Specter, puts up a countermeasure. Now, one of the things that drives me crazy, here is a really serious attack on an essential part of our liberties. I don't expect the Republican leadership to protest about it, but where are the Democrats? I haven't heard a word from the very outspoken, showboating Howard Dean, nothing from Nancy Pelosi, nothing from Harry Reid. My two senators, Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer in New York, have been silent about practically all of what's been going on in attacks on our basic constitutional liberties. So the Democratic Party, you know, people say they're looking for some vision, something to identify themselves. Why on earth don't they identify themselves as Democrats, as protectors of the Constitution? Because clearly the president is not.
Nat Hentoff, defenders of the Patriot Act often claim that the provisions of this legislation help fight terrorism. In fact, President Bush himself claimed 400 people were arrested and 200 convicted under the Patriot Act, protecting the nation from terrorism. The Washington Post, as you and listeners know, found out later it was really only 39 people connected with terrorism convicted under that bill. How important is the Patriot Act to the fight against terrorism, in your view?
Well, I'll give you an indication. During one of the public hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Valerie Caproni, who is the head of the legislative office of the FBI, was asked, can you show us any evidence that because there is a delay under the present law where you have to go to a judge to get this kind of subpoena, has there been any damage to national security? She paused and said, well, I can't give you any of that, but it could happen. It could happen. This is all a scam by the Justice Department, as it was under John Ashcroft and it is now under Alberto Gonzalez. There have been very, very few prosecutions under the Patriot Act. Most of the people who have been arrested, some have been deported for violations of immigration laws, but they haven't busted any cells. You know, the Lackawanna Six and all, once people began to examine those cases, they fell apart. So the Patriot Act, so far, all it's done is to give a lot of Americans, and then now I think about over almost 400 cities and towns and seven state legislatures, that have passed Bill of Rights defense resolutions telling their congressmen and congresswomen to stop this and change the Patriot Act, because there is a chill in the country, not among all people, but both conservatives and liberals in large numbers and growing numbers are afraid, because all of this stuff is secret.
What's at stake, in your view, with the Patriot Act and these enhanced provisions just passed by the Senate Intelligence Committee? What should citizens be concerned about when it comes to an erosion of the Bill of Rights?
If this continued assault on the essence of who we are, which is the Bill of Rights, and much of the rest of the Constitution, if there is another 9/11 or anything comparable to it, biochemicals released in subways, attacks on schools, hospitals, or whatever, the government, which is already now clearly feeling empowered to do what it wants. Some people may have seen on C-SPAN how in another committee, the House Judiciary Committee, James Sensenbrenner, because he was impatient and didn't want any opposition to what he was trying to push through, simply stopped he just knocked his gavel down and said, "We're through." And various congressmen said, hey, we're not through, but he just walked out. So there's an arrogance of power there. And if there is something like 9/11, we will be in the position, I think, and I try not to be, you know, say the sky is falling when it's only raining. But if there's another 9/11, there will be what the Japanese Americans had to experience during the Second World War. There will be internment camps for people who disagree too strongly with the government or who are suspected of disagreeing.
That was syndicated columnist and civil liberties advocate Nat Hentoff. Read Hentoff's columns online by going to the Village Voice website at www.villagevoice.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Myrowitz, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation, too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Tune in next Saturday, 2 to 4, for our next Making Waves program. We'll be featuring an interview with Shep Gerwitz, an activist on Native American issues and the brother of the late Lou Gerwitz, who was Leonard Peltier's attorney. June 26 marks the 30th year since the shootout at the Pine Ridge Reservation that led to charges against Leonard Peltier. Leonard remains in prison today, considered a political prisoner by many. Also, we will feature Jennifer Belkis with Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire. Following the Portsmouth-based gay, lesbian, transgender, and questioning support organization, Seacoast Outright, in celebrating June's Youth Pride in Boston, Jennifer asks, What is our home state doing for our queer youth? Find out what leaders, specialists, and your neighbors have to say. And we leave you now with this observation by economist and author of Small is Beautiful, E. F. Schumacher. Call a thing immoral or ugly, soul-destroying or a degradation of man, a peril to the peace of the world or to the well-being of future generations. But as long as you have not shown it to be uneconomic, you have not really questioned its right to exist, grow, and prosper.